And Brother Frank did speak the truth when he said that I do need your prayers. I'm going to open this evening with a reading in the 15th chapter of St. John. I'm going to start with the first verse. And this is Christ speaking. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. Now you are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself, except it abide in the vine, no more can ye, except ye abide in me. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me ye can do nothing. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch, and is withered, and men gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. You know, really, there's at least two or three sermons right there. The common denominator of all these things is obedience to Christ. And it's a continuing obedience to Christ that starts when you first become aware of your need to follow those things that he has laid for us to follow. And it takes your entire life to go through those sentences right there. You can have all the commitment in the world even to him. And it's one of the hardest things that you have to do because you're a human being. And you have human being emotions. You have human experiences. You have temptations that Satan knows very well destroys humans, and he uses them very effectively against all of us. It's a continual battle, and I don't know how many times we've heard that from this pulpit. What weak men we are, and how tightly we have to cling to that rod of iron, the gospel of Christ. Now that's rhetoric. It's true. It's absolutely correct. It's true. It's rhetoric. There's nothing wrong with rhetoric. But how do you do it? How do you survive the things that this world places in your way to get you to reject the gospel of Christ? And it's a daily chore for Satan. It's a daily activity of his in each one of our lives. I don't believe I'm looking at anyone out there that Satan can just get to reject the gospel out of hand. I don't believe there's anyone out in this congregation tonight that's that way. So then how does he get to you? And how does he get to me? Well, there's a thing called perception. How you look at something and how I look at something. And he can take that thing which is an individual entity in each one of us, and he can stir a little bit of the works or the fruits of the world in with it, as it's in Galatians. And he can cause more damage to us individually and as a group from within than you can imagine. And he can do it quicker than you can imagine. Because the thing that follows very close upon the heels of our perceptions is our emotions. And all you have to do is get mad because somebody sees something different than you do. And his battle's half won. He's already won two rounds. I've got a little story to tell you. It's a joke. It's about this man and woman that spent all their lives down in the hill country. There was no electricity and there was no running water, and they used a horse and a buggy for transportation, and they spent all their life raising their kids. And as they got them off on their own, they decided to take a trip out to see some of the big sights in the big city. So they go into town. They see their first, what they call a south skyscraper, 7 stories tall. Big thing to them. They've never seen anything that tall before except trees, and most trees aren't that tall. And they stand in awe of that thing for a while. People going in and out the front door, so finally they get up enough nerve to go inside, and here they're in the lobby, and it's all polished and shiny and clean smelling. And pretty soon they're noticing that right directly in front of them, this little thing looks like 2 doors together. So this other couple about their age walks up, and they stand there a minute, and they notice that there's an arrow above those doors, and the arrow does this, and then these 2 doors open up, and this couple walks in. And the door is shut, and the arrow above the doors does this, and then it does this. The door's open, and out comes a couple, looks like they're about 20 years old. And Paul looks at Mom and says, "Mom, I wonder what the kids would say if we ran ourselves through that." Now that's a perception. That's a complete misperception, but it's a perception. And really, if you stop and think about jokes, that's what they are about. It's one person's misperception of something that's going on, or misconception of what's going on. And that's a light side of perceptions, but there's a serious side. But the same thing happens there. You look at something, you see exactly what the guy next to you sees, and you see it differently. I've been reading a book on the Mayan on the Mesoamerican civilizations, not just Mayan. And of course, they come across with the wrong perception that everything came across the Bering Straits, as they have for centuries. And then they get into the Aztecs that believe that the world has been destroyed 4 times already. They get into a bunch of other things that a lot of these civilizations base their religious beliefs on that to us is a misperception, but that's the way they saw it. To me, the proof of the pudding in a lot of what's down there today is what you see down there today, and that is altars to sacrifice. A civilization that was on, I guess you say, the cutting edge of knowledge and technology, and today is nothing. It's almost a sub-civilization. It's subservient to everything there. You have the same thing in the Mideast. You have civilizations over there that for thousands of years have been in existence, and they were the cutting edge of knowledge and technology over there. And today they're second class, I guess you'd say, in all those areas. It's perception that put them there. It's what they thought that they were seeing and what they didn't bother to go any further to study and to look up, I guess you'd say. And they let somebody else tell them how to believe and what to think and how to live. If you look at world history, you'll see that everything runs in cycles. You can go back as far as you want to. Everything runs in cycles. And there's all different kinds of cycles. There's 20-year, there's 40-year, there's 200-year, there's 2,000-year cycles. There's cycles through and through and through the Book of Mormon on people that repent, become humble, worship God, end up with a better way of living, forget God, become evil, hit bottom, realize where they are, repent, and it just goes around and around and around. We do that. We are doing that as a country. We are doing that as a church. We are doing that as families, and we are doing that as individuals. Human nature does not let you believe exactly the same thing with the same degree of fervency 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You have peaks and you have valleys. You have good days and you have bad days. This was my bad week, as Frank referred to. But it's what we do many times denotes what happens to us, as did the Mayans, as did the Aztecs, as did the Iraqis, as our ancestors here have done, as countries like Britain have done, and France, and Greece, and Italy. And really, the more that I thought about this, the more applicable those things were to what I read here in St. John. For example, every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away, and every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it. He doesn't take a branch that produces fruit and leaves it alone. That's one of the big pitfalls or one of the traps that we fall into, whether it's singly or as group or any kind of a group, you know, family group, church group, national group. Everything's fine, long, great. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Pretty soon, human nature says you ignore it because, you know, we're not static. We never stay in one spot. We have our peaks and valleys. How many times have you that work have seen a procedure start out with a simple little procedure on something, and within 6 months or a year, it has evolved into something that's its own entity? I've seen it a half a dozen times where I work. One little thing to make your life easier, and by the time you get done with it, you got 9 reports to do, and they're all in triplicate, and they got to go to 6 different places, and 3 of them you got to keep on file. That's the humanness in us. That is not the humanness in Christ. With a branch, you've got a peach tree. Produces all kinds of fruit, produces beautiful fruit. Gets these little suckers on the branches, and if you don't break them off and they become their own branches, and pretty soon you've got too much tree for the root system, what happens to the tree? Right. You don't have much of a fruit tree left. Well, now how do you take that concept to your religious convictions? How do you take it and apply it to your religious life? The Aztecs, every time that they conquered a people, they decided to go through that civilization's religion and pick out the gods that were they thought would be acceptable and add them to theirs. You take a look at how the Mayans, how they evolved and how they decayed. They never plucked the suckers off. The Aztecs never plucked the suckers off. They added the suckers. What do we do? What do we do with our religious studies? What do we do with our religious experiences? How do we apply what we know is in the Bible and the Book of Mormon and what is true to the problems that we face every day? Like honesty and lust and envy and pride and ego. When we come up in a situation at work, or if you don't work, say at the grocery store, or at, even within our own group, you know, like with United Workers, I'll just pick them. I'm not picking on them, I'm just picking them. And somebody comes up with a suggestion and they're not your favorite people. Well, now, what's the first thing in your mind? is it a good suggestion, or you're not going to take it no matter what because you don't like that person? They've done something wrong against you, or they're just not your type. That's succumbing to a temptation if you do that. That's a flaxen thread. That's one little wrap around your soul. That's one little wrap around your heart. It doesn't take a whole lot to break that one little flaxen thread. But if you let that continue, and you let that continue the wrap, pretty soon they've got a pretty good bind on you. We had a real good example of that down in Phoenix one year. And Brother Mosier preached a sermon on that, and it took him quite a while to tie up Joel to where he couldn't break it, but he got it done, and he used sewing thread. You know, when they start an army, or not so much when they start an army, but when they take a young man into the army, he's taught to fight. That's his goal. And as they run him through boot camp, they just plain change his attitude about things. They change him to obey without thinking, pretty much. They get him enthused. They get him pumped up to think he is the meanest, baddest person around. You know, really that same principle goes with when we have church services. We come in here and we pump each other up, and we think nothing can hurt us out in the world. And we can get so fired up we think that we are totally invincible. The soldier's moment of truth comes when they launch him into the beach or put him in a trench to jump off at dawn, and now he stands there and faces what he's been trained to do, and the proof of the pudding is in how well they've been able to convince him to perform from that point on, and he knows it. Where's our proof of the pudding? It's nothing as dramatic and it's nothing as abrupt that we can see, but our proof in the pudding is when we walk out that door each time. The perceptions, the studies, the way we study, what we study in here determines how we survive out there. I had the occasion to preach or to help with a funeral. I didn't preach it, thank goodness. Alvin had that burden, and it was a burden. Last Wednesday. We had a cousin that was killed in a car accident down in Salem, Missouri. And he was 19 years old. He was the son of a man that was a perfectionist. He was the son of a man that was just driven unbelievably to excel in everything he did. And this is what he taught his son. And as is many times the case, when the boy got into high school, why, he was an extension of what his, since his dad was aging by then, you know, he was an extension of his dad. You know, his dad was all puffed up because of all the accomplishments of his son. And he tried out for the baseball team and was one of the best outfielders I'd ever seen in years, and when he found that out, he quit because it was no longer a challenge. Went out for track. Found out he could unofficially break the time, I think it was for a half mile or something. So when he found out he could do that, he quit and he went to something else. This is the way his dad lives. His dad liked an FBI agent called Purvis back in the 20s. Thought he was a good role model because he was flashy and he was invincible and he fought crime, so he became an FBI agent. And he got good enough at it that he was legal attaché in the embassy over, in the American embassy over in Bonn, Germany for the last part of his career. So he retired and he'd moved to Salem, Missouri. And the challenge down there was the political system, so he became a county judge. Then he became presiding county commissioner. As far as you can go in Dent County, Missouri. He succeeded in everything he did, and he's known down there as a perfectionist, John is. And this is how he taught his son to live. He just left out religion. He didn't believe, he didn't really think that, you know, you don't have to be too churchy, it's a waste of time. So this boy followed in his dad's footsteps, as all boys do. And he excelled in everything he could excel in. Everything he touched, he tried the hardest and he became the best. He was a rich man's kid, so he had him a big Dominator GT Mustang, had a big boom box in it. So all the other kids in town that had money got their big muscle cars and their big boom boxes. And there's one thing I found out down there that I was extremely uncomfortable was most of the parents of these kids backed this. And this boy died playing a game. It's called Run from the Police. They've had 6 boys in Salem, Missouri area die in 30 days doing this. How's that for results? And the night this boy died, there was one died at 10 p.m. from running from the police, and he died at 1 a.m. same night. And they weren't even chasing him, really, because they were going on another call, and they just hadn't pulled in behind him. He saw the red lights and punched it. Turned his boom box up full blast. Everybody knows what he did. Well, the people that I talked to, that they know that's what he did, because when he went by them, his foot in the floor, they could hear the boom box above everything else. 1.5 miles on down the road, he was dead. Went off a curve, car floated on him. Come up off the ground in the curve. And GTs do not win when they come up against oak trees. His dad perceived that the thing to make that boy do was succeed in everything he did. He was going to be the best. He was going to be first. He was going to be the brain. And it was his perception that that's what it took to succeed in this world. Well, he was right. Now what about the world hereafter? Now what about the peace that you get from the Holy Spirit? What about it had not have happened at all with the perception of you don't do things like that? It was like I was in China or somewhere down there. It really was. The whole town came. They shut down the courthouse for this service. And I will brag on Alvin. He gave them a good sermon. And there were some people that really squirmed. And they needed it. But as I stood up there looking out over, somewhere around, I guess there were 300 people there, I couldn't help but think, I sure wish I'd have rather been standing right here looking at you all than where I was. But at the same time, maybe that's all they ever got in the way of exposure. But then again, what's their perception of what I stand up and say? Was I a waste of time? Did I prick a conscience? I don't know. I hope I pricked a lot of consciences. I definitely hope Alvin pricked a lot of consciences down there. After the service, of which the 17-year-old girlfriend had a large say in, that's why we had the music we had and a few other things. There was nothing sacrilegious about the service at all. It's just that there would have been no way I'd have done a lot of those things in a service. they thought it was pretty good service. Yeah, I mean, it really served their purpose. So they got a lot of comfort out of it. They got nothing. They really honestly got nothing. They had a lot of materialism. They had a lot of ego. Anybody who was anybody in that county was there that day. So they had a lot of prestige, and there was a lot of power there. Anybody that was law or law enforcement or lawyer or medical profession or civic leader was there that day. I mean, they had it all. All the big cheeses were there. They had nothing. There were two guys sitting in front of that thing. It was all alone because really the only comfort we had was prayer. The only comfort we had was Mom Harris and some other of her brothers and sisters that were sitting there in front that we knew that believed in Christ and we knew were just as distressed as we were. That was our perception. That was their perception. How do you take people that go to church and give them, or how do they acquire those values? And most of those people went to church. There was a man named Diego de Landa. He was a Catholic priest, and he went to a town called Mani, down in Yucatan. And he was so shocked by the Mayan religious ceremonies and all the sacrificial things and all this down there that he vowed to destroy the Mayan history and religion so there wouldn't be any way that they could ever go back to it. So he did. He burned every book he could find. He burned everything he could find. And that was his first blush, I guess you'd say, his first exposure to them. And when I first heard about it, you know, the first thing you think of is, boy, this is some terrible person that come in here and he was just bloody and terrible and awful and he was doing his best to destroy these people and all this. That's my perception, my first perception of him. But if you stop and think, what he was doing was he was wanting to get rid very much of the very things that we commit our lives to get rid of. All those things that horrified him would horrify even me if we had to face them. Because really, all there is down there in those ceremonies is the worship of Satan. I know of no other god that they sacrifice human beings to. Whether they say that that's who it is or not. It's that simple. But this Catholic priest, after he did all this, then he became, the more he was with these Mayans, the more he became aware that there's really something special about these people. Now, if you didn't know he was a Catholic priest, and you heard that some man back then said there's really something special about the Mayans, what would you perceive that to mean? It's all destroyed when I say he's a Catholic priest, of course. But then he devoted the rest of his life to completely recording everything he could write down about the Mayans. When we perceive things, it's usually a result of two things. Our experiences, and that takes a whole bunch of subtitles there, a whole bunch of sublabels with our experiences and the scriptures. Sister Jean Chapman last Sunday morning in Sunday school class bemoaned the fact that she didn't know what to say to someone she was talking to, and they made the statement that they believe in the rapture. So she immediately had a verse pop to her mind to read to prove that there was no rapture, as they have it defined. which is, you know, that they won't, there will be no tribulation, that those of God's children will be taken away, and they'll not suffer anything, and everybody else that's left here will be sinners. And to her dismay, he immediately comes across with the same verse to prove there was a rapture. Perception. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that in a religious sense? You know, it's real, well, comparatively, it's not real easy, but comparatively, it's a whole lot easier to sort in your mind for or against alcohol consumption, for or against tobacco, for or against all the lusts of the flesh, for or against all these things. How do you sort in your mind using the same verse to prove an opposite point that you want to prove? And what's the first thing you have to do to even start? Well, it's a very simple concept and a very hard thing to do to begin with that you've got to start with. And that is, you can't get mad. You can't get defensive. You can't get hateful. You can't threaten, because then you shut the door. That's what you do when somebody threatens you, isn't it? That's what they do when you do it to them. But it says in here that every branch must be purged. I know I've heard that interpreted a couple of three different ways. That we must go through and consciously subjugate ourselves to chastisement or whatever, periodically, and that's purging. Well, maybe it is. And maybe it can also become a rote thing to do that becomes its own ceremony. You know, that's what happened to the Catholic Church. Everything that they tried so hard to do to begin with has now become a rote ceremony. And it's a mindless thing that they do because they get paid to do it. And it's a church that has been in that business, and it really is a business to them, for so long that they, you know, they go for the tax breaks, they had the Inquisition in Spain, you know, to kill everybody or to get rid of everybody that didn't believe like they believed, to torture them and to get them confess that they were devils. What kind of a mindset is that? What kind of a mindset is it that takes something that is as deep and as hard a commitment to fulfill as following the gospel of Christ in your heart and letting all the things come out that are supposed to be the fruits of that commitment and enforcing somebody to do it? We don't have time to convince them anymore. Let's make them do it. We'll pass a law, and if they don't do it right, we'll throw them. We'll jail them, we'll kill them, we'll burn them, whatever they did. You know, they found out back in the, what was it, the 20s in this country, that you can't legislate an attitude. They tried it with liquor. We all know what happened in the roaring 20s. You want to get rid of something like that, you start at home with the parents teaching the kids. And many times it's teaching by example. And there's things like hate and envy and pride and emulating other people, keeping up with the Joneses, rumors. See, those are the things that Satan can use to A, alter our perceptions of things or alter our stated perception of things. Cause us to be suspicious one of another. When I first became exposed to this church, it didn't really take me too long to become aware of the fact that there were two camps. That was my perception. That was my perception of it. And that I really had to watch myself or I'd get churched. Now that definition was you got thrown out. Well, I'd been through that in the Christian church in Buckner, Missouri. And I'd been through that in the Baptist church in Sepulveda, California. And I'd been through that in the Presbyterian church in Petersburg, Kansas. And I was tired of that. That's how I grew up, was going in churches where if you didn't do exactly the right thing and they decided you didn't do the right thing, they threw you out of it. Didn't have to really do a sin, you just didn't believe like they did. And my grandfather would throw somebody out of his Baptist church quicker than anybody else if they even began to argue with him about the Bible. He was an expert. My grandfather knew the Bible frontwards and backwards, and you could tell him a verse and a book, a chapter and a verse, and he could recite it to you, or he could recite the whole thing to you, the whole Bible. But I know now that he didn't know what we know about the Bible. Because there's a big difference between being able to recite the whole thing and knowing exactly where everything's at and knowing what it means, having the correct perception of it. My grandfather fell under a thing that it talks about in Ecclesiastes. Solomon talks about it, and it's called studying the Bible too much. He read that so much, and he went so far beyond what his experiences would teach him about right and wrong in the Bible that he didn't know very much about it, and he didn't understand it near as well and couldn't apply it anywhere near as well as we could or as we can. When we apply ourselves, just like the peach tree that you don't take any of the suckers off of and it grows beyond the roots, if you don't study the Bible and the Book of Mormon with the intent of learning how to stay away from the things that Satan puts in your path every day, as subtly as he can, using your emotions and your perceptions to trip you up. That's what studying the Bible's for. That's what studying the Book of Mormon's for. That's what prayer's for. That's what Sunday school and church and prayer meeting and fellowship, that's what those things are for, to keep us out of those traps. This isn't some fraternal organization. This isn't a social club. This isn't a place to go be seen. This is survival. And with what goes on out in this world today, this is survival. And in an organization like this, you can't be a sometime Christian. Well, I'll be a Christian on Sunday, or I'll be a Christian when I need something. Or if I get in trouble, then I'll go to church. If I can get out of this, and then when you're out of it, you're gone. Christ never made a mystery out of your soul's salvation. It is no big mystery to you on what it takes to obey God and to endure to the end and to follow in His footsteps. But it's how you perceive what's written is what you get out of it. And according as I have commanded you, this shall you baptize. And this is the next point he made. And there shall be no disputations among you, as there hath hitherto been. Neither shall there be disputations among you concerning the points of my doctrine, as there hath hitherto been. Why would he say that? What in the world would make him come right out of the blue and say something like that? What makes him come out of the blue and say anything like that? Because he knows what's in the hearts of men. He knows human nature. He knows people. He knows what they've been up to, just like he does today. For verily, verily, I say unto you, and it's important enough that he repeats it, he that hath a spirit of contention is not of me, but is of the devil. He didn't just stop there. He gave the transverse side of it, I guess you'd say. He didn't just stop it, it's not of me. Which is a father of contention? And he stirreth up the hearts of men to contend with anger one with another. Behold, this is not my doctrine, to stir up the hearts of men with anger one against another, but this is my doctrine, that such things should be done away. Behold, verily, verily, I say unto you, I will declare unto you my doctrine, and this is my doctrine, and it is the doctrine which your Father has given unto me. Now, there isn't a whole lot many more ways he can cover that. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's any other way he's covered it at every point in any way you can look at that. What makes us fall away? What makes us stray off? What makes us discouraged? The failure to look at these things in such a way that we get what we're supposed to get out of them. The good seed that grows in your breast. You all know that passage. It's in there. How do you check? You come up on a situation. Let's just stay within the Church of Christ here. And we come up on a situation and something is presented. I don't have any idea what it would be because we're getting something all the time in conference or something. Or even in study class or whatever. Something is presented. How do you know it's of God? How do you know it's of God? You break it down to what the point, what's the objective of the thing? What is it intended to do? How does it compare with the human nature of you and me? Has it been done before? Did it work before? Why didn't it work before? If not, or why did it work before? And if it was before, why did it fail? Why aren't we still doing it? These are very simple questions. And there's some very simple answers to most of them, yes and no. And when you go back to the things that are in the Bible, in the Book of Mormon, they will tell you what will happen to that thing. And it doesn't make any difference what kind of an idea or concept it is. Does it have the charity that God talks about? Does it have the love? Does it have the fruit of the Spirit within it? Or does it have the lust of the world within it? Does it create pride? Does it create humility? Is it something to make somebody look important because they've got a great idea? Or does it help us stick together? Does it lift up one man and put him above everybody else? Does it make you feel closer to your brother? Does it help us grow as a group? And therefore we grow as individuals also. Do we purge those things that we should not have? Do we claim or grasp or strain or strive for the wrong things? Are we selfish? Are we lazy? That's always my big argument whenever I get a complaint at work. You all know where I work. There's no such thing as a stupid cop. There's just a lot of lazy ones out there. You'd be surprised how often laziness is a downfall of things. We don't want to take the time to do. We don't want to take the time to make ourselves assume the attitude that controls our behavior that follows the rod of iron. When we got done with that funeral Wednesday, everybody else was gone, and Mom Harris comes up to me and she says, I've got something that's a terrible burden on my heart, and I've got to tell you. She says, your dad has suffered a stroke. And he's in the hospital in Fort Scott, Kansas. Well, that's quite a ways from there, and I was already tired, but Cynthia and I went. My mom believes in Christ. I've got a brother that's a Baptist that lives there. And they're very active in their church. And I've got a sister and her husband that he's a pastor and they don't like for them to be called this, but they're Camelites. It's Church of Christ. They want to be known as Church of Christ in Tulsa. They were there. And we drove about 4 hours, and we went from one world to another. We went from a world of superficial feelings and emotions and pride and no Christ and no God, to one where all these brothers and sisters of mine may be in different denominations, but the common denominator was the peace and the strength that not only could God give us in our trial, but helping Dad. It was a huge change. It was a welcome change. I obviously don't believe the doctrines that my brothers and sisters believe. And they don't believe the doctrine that each of the other ones of us believe. We're all different denominations. But with that group there, it was totally different in the way we perceived our tragedy than the way the relatives that live in Salem perceive their tragedy. Somewhere down the road, it may be in my lifetime, it may not be in my lifetime, it's going to come the prophecy that there will only be two churches. And I have found out through reading and trying to apply what I've read in the scriptures to the experiences of my life that there aren't very many black and whites. There's things I'm dead set against, and there's things that I won't do, and there's things that I will not agree to do. Just right out of hand. But there are very few black and white to where you can just arbitrarily say, this is the way it is, and this is what you go do. It takes the time to sit down with a person and find out why they're in what they're in. And then you've got to find out their personality, and then you've got to figure out how to help them, using these as a guideline on how to get out of their problem. And that's what I have to do with my problems. So there are no easy, quick black and whites. And I have found out many times through my sticks of my own that my perceptions are wrong on what's in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. I didn't say the Bible and the Book of Mormon is wrong. I said my perceptions of what's in there is wrong. First time I really stuck my foot in my mouth was with my brother and brother-in-law and sister in Tulsa, the pastor of that Church of Christ, when I told him we didn't believe in open communion like he does. Why not? Well, you're just not supposed to serve anybody outside your own church. You're stuck up? No, we just are not going to serve you. Well, that didn't put much credibility on the rest of your religion. That was his answer. And I realized I'd backed myself in a corner. Now, I don't think I'm still out of it with him. But I don't just haul off and do that anymore. And there are ways of convincing people and keeping them listening. I am convinced of that. I'm just not good enough at it yet. We have, what, 60 people here tonight, 70 people? So we have that many perceptions. We have that many of you out there that have had all your own experiences in life, and you balance them against the values that either you learned on your own and or your parents and or your older relatives have taught you. You've even come from different parts of the country, and that does make a difference. It really honestly does. It's not good or bad, it's just different. It's just different, and I'm starting to find that out. Our common denominator is our belief in the Bible and in the Book of Mormon, and that it's true. There lies our hope. There lies our future, because it's what we do here now is what we are teaching our young ones, and they will be taking up the reins before we really want to admit. And then our proof of the pudding will come. on whether we've succeeded or not. And there will be peaks and valleys in it, just like there is in your lives. And the absolutely amazing thing to me about all of that, and all that's been going on for thousands and thousands of years, is that it's still here and it hasn't changed, and it still applies today like it did from day one back then. You can find the solutions in here. They may not be easy ones, and they may not be the ones you like, but they're the correct ones. And that's part of my enduring to the end. And the joy of knowing when I have finally figured out how something in these books really works to help me get through a problem, or to prevent one, or to stay away from one. Problems being temptations, problems being problems, problems being tragedies, answers. Uncle John's hard-headed. That's the one that locks the boy down there. Most people in Bent County call him sir, and that's about all they ever want to say to him. And I got him convinced that he screwed up his life. Because the last thing he said to me as I left that funeral home when I headed for Fort Scott, I told him, I says, you know, somewhere down the road you're going to get another challenge. And I didn't have to say anymore because he finished it for me from our conversation the night before. He says, yes, and when that one comes, he says, I don't want to mess it up like I messed up this last boy. So he knows. He really, on his own, told me without prompting, he knows. My prayer is that he'll look and search to find the right way, because right now I know that he doesn't know the right way. We know the right way. We know what we're supposed to do. We know what our responsibilities are, and we know the cause. We're supposed to know anyway, the cause and effects of everything in our lives. When we do this, this is going to happen. When we treat somebody this way, this is what is going to happen. When we treat somebody that way, that is what's going to happen. And it says so right there. When we decide to do this, this is what's going to happen. When we decide to do that, that is what's going to happen. I'm looking at a lot of people with a lot of dedication and that have done a lot of labor for the Lord right now. I've seen a lot of good things come out of this group. I've seen lives turned around, and you're looking at one of them. And that's just exactly the group that Satan wants his hooks into. And the only way he can get them into you folks is you never know he does it. So he'll start with your attitude and your perceptions of things. And he'll get you to split. He'll get you to divide. He'll get you to be discouraged. He'll get you mad. He'll get you hateful. Because those are the things that Christ does not abide. And when works occur with those things in mind, it's not the work of the Lord. It says so right there. And I read, to a degree, I read it a while ago. There's a lot of problems in this world. And the greatest treasure that we have, too many times we take for granted. Too many times we get used to it. I became aware of that this last week, being exposed to the opposite side, I guess you'd say. I'm very thankful I have all of you. And I'm very thankful that we all have someone to go to for our strength and our guidance. Thank you. Thank you.